are about to segue to our conversation with author Aidan Levy, author of Saxophone Classics, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. He is joining us from his home in South Central Pennsylvania. And we're getting all our technical ducks lined up here. And good afternoon, Aidan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate your time, and as we've been discussing in the studio here, it is a doorstopper of a book, and I'm not intimidated by big books, and it was a joy to learn about Sonny's life in detail from, we can't say birth to death because he's still very much with us, but what an amazing life he's had. And just a little bit about yourself, your association with WRTC in the early years from way back.
That's right. I grew up in West Hartford, and when I was a student at Hall High School, I started hosting a jazz show at WRTC, so the station has always had a place in my heart, and when I'm back in town, I always make sure that I tune in as soon as I'm within reach. So, yeah, it's really an honor to be on the air again on WRTC.
Well, and we appreciate your time, and again, just a magnificent magisterial work in putting this this book together. If I'm remembering the numbers correctly, 7 years of research and writing.
That's right. Yeah, 7 years.
And is someone who's not intimidated by big books, 700 plus pages of narrative, and what's not obvious is the fact that you have just one page in the back referencing endnotes, because you have to go to an online PDF to see 414 pages of endnotes, which I find just absolutely staggering. How did you keep all that straight in the course of your writing?
It was very difficult, and I wrote the main text, and I kept kind of notes on what would eventually become the end notes to the book. Anyone out there listening should be clear that if you're interested in the book, you don't need to read the end notes, but it's exhaustively cited. So if anybody's curious as to where I got a piece of information, or if you want to read more on any particular subject, you can always find that in the end notes.
And as an author myself, I can certainly appreciate that, because as writers of nonfiction, you do have to make sure that you do have those citations. But again, just the overwhelming amount of information there that for other scholars and researchers who want to learn more about where all this information came from, I just found it just incredible. When reading books by Robert Caro, for example, and the extensive end notes, it's really something, and very comforting knowing that you took the attention to be able to include that for other people to learn. But back to Sonny Rollins, one thing that I noticed that really jumped out in the book was the fluidity of the personnel that he used. And in some cases, it almost seemed like somebody showing up at the playground basketball court, and you just have a pickup game with whoever's available. And in many instances, I found it quite compelling that Sonny almost did the same thing with some of the recordings, that he gravitated to some of his preferred musicians. But in other cases, he used whoever was just available, whether in the studio or for going on tour.
That's right. He was notoriously hard on drummers, and I interviewed dozens of drummers for the book, and everybody said something similar, that if you had the drum chair in Sonny Rollins' band, you were in the hot seat, and he made you sweat, quite literally. One drummer told me that if he didn't take a change of shirt so that he would be able to make it through a concert, that he'd be soaking wet by the end. And that's something that everybody learned if they wanted to play with Sonny Rollins. Other drummers, like Roy McCurdy, who's a legend in his own right, told me that Sonny used to crouch right next to the bass drum so that he could really internalize the drum beat, get that visceral rhythm going. But if he didn't like what he was hearing, he might write a note and slip it under the door of the hotel that night, which he started doing with McCurdy. And finally, McCurdy gave it everything he had, left it all on the stage, and he got a note that night saying, "Dear Roy, thank you. SR.
I remember that passage and him not being the easiest guy to work with. But also it kind of plays a little bit to his eccentric personality. And I remember hearing a story a while back when I certainly didn't know as much about Sonny Rollins as I do now, that he arrived at one gig and started playing the saxophone as soon as he stepped out of the taxi cab. And I thought, well, this is a one-off kind of a thing. And as you point out numerous times throughout the narrative of your book, this was almost standard procedure for him. He'd play coming out of the dressing room. He'd start at the back of the back of the auditorium, whatever. That was all part of his personality.
It was, and he had a compulsion to practice. Sometimes the best music would be made during the sound check, and when he finished a concert, people would hear him playing from the dressing room. It's also something that underscores his belief that the music could be anywhere and everywhere, that it started before the concert began and it went on after it was over. So, yeah, it's something that the band members had to get used to. They had to make sure that they showed up early, but sometimes Sonny would surprise them by starting the concert before they were ready. So they really had to be ready for anything.
And you point that out because there were numerous occasions where his bandmates were almost just blindly given some sheet music practically at the last minute, and they would practice for a day or two. And then the night of the performance, he said, well, we're doing something else. That apparently didn't happen that often, but it did happen on occasion.
That's right. Or he'd call it in a different key, and they would need to be able to play it just instantaneously.
Right.
Sometimes he would call it in one key and he would start playing it in another.
Right. And for those just joining us, we're speaking with Aidan Levy, a native of West Hartford, who has authored a magnificent book, The Life of Sonny Rollins. Saxophone Colossus is the title, subtitle, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. And as an historian myself, what I really appreciate is the fact that you've woven in some cultural aspects as far as what's going on in America, in New York in particular, at the time that Sonny is growing up and playing in the city. For example, one thing I found compelling was the fact that you had jazz clubs gravitating away from Harlem and very interestingly settling on West 52nd Street, which, if I'm thinking of the geography correctly, just west of Radio City and Rockefeller Center.
That's right. And music started to shift down to 52nd Street around the time of the Second World War. But the original Swing Street was up in Harlem. And Sonny began frequenting that street, and then when it shifted downtown, he would go to the clubs there. And in order to get in, he'd put on a trench coat and get an eyebrow pencil from his mother and paint on a mustache, kind of like Groucho Marx. And the club owners would look the other way. So that's how he and his friends would get into the clubs on 52nd Street when they were underage, and they'd be able to see people like Coleman Hawkins, Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, sometimes all on the same night.
And another cultural aspect that you touch on, it's very important for people to understand that we think sort of in very generic terms about just understanding and appreciating the music, but the very tragic circumstances of so many of these performers becoming addicted to drugs or other substance abuse, and I thought you did a very good job in covering that.
Well, it's a complicated story, and it's an international story, so that's something that I wanted to draw attention to, that heroin flooded Harlem in the late 1940s, and in 1948, when Sonny Rollins was turning 18, the drug was just everywhere in the streets. And he looked up to musicians like Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday and read that they were using. He got to know Charlie Parker personally, and like many musicians of his generation, fell under the delusion that it was the drug that was in part responsible for his genius. In addition to that, Sonny and his crew felt that it was kind of a buffer to hold themselves at arm's length, from a hostile society. So they all started using. And Sonny thought of this as the scourge eventually, because it quickly became apparent that it had an extremely adverse effect on their artistry and also on their lifestyle. But it was years before Sonny was able to kick his habit, and he vowed to himself and to Charlie Parker that he would do it. He was, in fact, inspired by Parker to quit heroin after they had a recording session together with Miles Davis that was later released as Collector's Items. And that was recorded in 1953, and Sonny showed up in the studio, and Bird was under the impression that Sonny was clean, that he hadn't been using. And Sonny recalls that Bird had just this beaming smile, seeing that Sonny had not followed his example. But later on in the session, someone else in the band said, yeah, Sonny and I were shooting up before we got here. And Sonny overheard this exchange, and he saw from across the studio Bird's face fall. And just at that moment, he vowed that he would have to change his lifestyle, that Charlie Parker's message was really do as I say, not as I do. And he wanted his acolytes to follow his musical example, but not the example of his lifestyle. Unfortunately, after Sonny was able to kick his habit at a rehab center in Lexington, Kentucky, Charlie Parker died, so he wasn't able to show him that he did get the message. But yes, it was a very difficult period for Sonny and his peers, and many people didn't make it to the other side.
Yeah, and what I want to do right now, our time is going very quickly here. What I want to do is I've added to my playlist a song that I would not be doing on a traditional jazz show, but this is part of the learning experience I had from reading your book. So I'm going to drop a track in here, and then I'll let you explain the circumstances of it when we come back on the air. So everybody can hang with me, but here we go. Okay, we're back with Aidan Levy, author of Saxophone Classics, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. And one of my learning experiences with the book was related directly to this particular song. Could you tell the story about this, Aidan?
Well, one of the biggest fans of Sonny Rollins was Charlie Watts. And when the Rolling Stones were putting together what became the album Tattoo You, based on outtakes and unreleased tracks, they wanted a saxophone solo on a few of the songs. And Charlie Watts said, you know, wouldn't it be great to get Sonny Rollins? And Mick Jagger said, well, let's get him. Mick Jagger just celebrated his 80th birthday. Sonny's a bit older. He'll be 93 this September. And Charlie Watts said, no, Sonny will never do it. He'll never do it. And Charlie Watts is originally a jazz drummer.
Yes.
And for his whole career, he maintained a sideline with a jazz band. So anyway, Mick Jagger said, no, he'll do it. So he found a way to approach Sonny. And at first, Sonny was a little bit perplexed, and he called up his nephew, Clifton Anderson, trombonist, who worked with Sonny for 3 decades. And Sonny said, you know, I've heard of this group, but I've never heard their music. You know what? And Clifton said to him, you know, in so many words, like, Sonny, these are the Stones, man. And Sonny said, well, isn't that just derivative of the blues? So he wasn't too keen on doing it. But his wife, Lucille Rollins, who was his manager for 3 decades, starting in the early 1970s and until her passing in the early 2000s, convinced him to do it. But Sonny only agreed to do it on the circumstance that he not be credited on the album. So many people thought that it was a slight to Sonny that he was uncredited. But in fact, that was Sonny's intent, that if he was going to participate on a Rolling Stones album, that he'd go uncredited. So he went to the studio, and this is in the early 1980s, and he listened to some demo tracks, and he said to Mick Jagger, you know, what do you want me to do here? So Mick Jagger danced out what he was hoping he would do. And the result was this magnificent solo that you just heard on Waiting on a Friend. If you see the music video, there's no indication that it's Sonny Rollins. And in fact, one day, some months later, Sonny was in a supermarket in upstate New York where he was living, and he heard this song come on the radio, and it was the Rolling Stones, and he heard a saxophone solo. He said, huh, that sounds pretty good. I said, oh, wait a minute, that's me. So anyway, he did kind of a double take with that. The Stones were desperate to get Sonny to go on tour with them. And the resulting tour on the back of this album, Tattoo You, broke some concert records. A major tour. And they wanted to pay Sonny more than $1 million to go on tour. And all they wanted him to do was come and play just a few tracks. But Sonny felt that he didn't want to be an accessory to the Rolling Stones, and he had his own band, so he turned that money down. And that was just one aspect of Sonny's commitment to his own vision that I wanted to bring out in the book.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Aidan Levy, author of Saxophone Classics, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. One question I had from a listener wanted me to forward this to you, asking for a friend, literally. Miles Davis ended up with the preference of taking John Coltrane over Sonny, even though Sonny and Coltrane did play with Miles Davis at different times, that Coltrane emerged as the favorite. Could you explain that a little bit, of the evolution of that particular relationship?
Well, there's some wrinkles to that. So Miles Davis's favorite was Sonny Rollins. And in fact, Miles, when he was forming the first great quintet, he announced to the press that Sonny Rollins had already joined the band. And Sonny caught wind of this, but it was not true at all. Sonny had not joined the band. In fact, he was weighing two separate offers, one from Miles to join the first great quintet, or what became known as the first great quintet, and another offer from Max Roach and Clifford Brown to join the Max Roach Clifford Brown quintet. And Sonny knew that the Roach Brown quintet was known for clean living, and that the Miles Davis quintet might bring him back into some old habits.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the decision, even though Miles would be much closer to home in New York, that he would join the Roach Brown Quintet. And jazz fans started showing up at concerts, and they even would sometimes see Sonny's name on the marquee, and they'd find this unknown saxophone player in his stead. And they were really disappointed. And, of course, it was John Coltrane.
One of the interesting tidbits I liked in the book was Sonny was playing a gig outdoors at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and there was traffic outside the venue. You couldn't see it, but you could hear it, and he played sort of in tandem when he heard a honking horn out in the street that he would kind of honk and answer back, and it just places this wonderful eccentric personality that Sonny brought to the stage and the arena. And I'm taking it that he had an approachable personality. And did you interview? I think you did interview Sonny at different points in the course of your research.
Yes, we spoke many times over the course of the years as I researched and wrote the book. And then after I completed the manuscript, I sent the whole thing to him in the thickest binder that I could find at Office Depot. And I printed it out. It was, if you can believe it, about twice as long as the published book. And I mailed it to Sonny Rollins, and I called him on the phone to talk about it. And actually, he called me and said, you know, I started reading it, and I've got to tell you, I'm not gonna read all of this. I said, okay, well, that's understandable. You know, Sonny could barely listen to his own playback from a studio session. I wasn't surprised to think that he couldn't read what at times is a play-by-play of his life. But I thought, maybe he's telling me this for a reason. So I said, Sonny, how about this? Why don't we go through the whole manuscript and I'll kind of summarize it for you, and you can make comments or additions, and we'll just talk it through so that you know everything that's in this book. And he said, actually, that would be great. So we had a series of about a dozen conversations, each of them about 3 hours long, and we talked through the entire book. And he made additions and comments, and much of that made it into the final manuscript. So a lot of the original material in the first draft was cut, but there were also these additions that came from those conversations. And he was extremely generous with his time, and I think it just shows the strength of character that he wanted to make sure that the story was presented accurately. But he didn't censor the book in any way.
What was the biggest thing that you learned about Sonny Rollins in all these conversations? And what a wonderful privilege to be able to have access like that. But what's the biggest thing that you learned about him, say, vis-a-vis before you started the project?
Well, I knew that Sonny dedicated himself to practice and that he was one of the hardest working musicians in the history of the music, but I don't think I grasped how hard he really did work to become Sonny Rollins. Just the hours and hours of practice, just the blood that he gave to this music and this art form. And it's something that he has continued to do through to today. Even though he can't play anymore, he's still learning, he's still trying to improve, And there were just so many examples of what that dedication and that conviction looked like. And I document that throughout the book. So, I mean, I think of that as one of the great lessons of Sonny Rollins, that you can never let up. You just have to keep on pushing. And I think that the experience of writing the book, and I hope the experience of reading the book, demonstrates what it really means to dedicate yourself to a craft, to an art form, and kind of to a certain art of living. That doesn't mean it's fun, but I think that for Sonny Rollins, it was worth it.
And all to his credit, and this is noticeable to me too, just as you've mentioned, after that second stint at Rikers and then his rehab down in Lexington, Kentucky, that he really made a concerted effort to turn his life around, and the healthy living, the healthy diet. One passage, he shows up as a guest at somebody's house. He brought a box of grapes. Not exactly the type of thing you might expect to bring to a friend's party or whatever. But again, just so emblematic of how he had turned his life around for the better and continued on in his musicianship for as long as he possibly could.
That's right. And I think that he credits his longevity to making that change in his lifestyle and trying to bring some sense of balance to everything he was doing in his life. His focus on physical fitness, healthy eating, enlightenment, spiritual self-revelation, all of this, I think, contributed to his success as a performing and touring musician, and avoiding the kind of burnout that afflicted so many of his contemporaries. So, yeah, as I said, Sonny will be 93 this September, and that's in no small part due to the fact that he decided to really start taking care of himself.
Absolutely, and the music world is all the better for it. And again, we've been speaking the last half hour with author Aidan Levy, native of West Hartford, Connecticut, just released, I guess, the tail end of last year, his monumental work, Saxophone Colossus, The Life and Music of Sonny Rollins. Aidan, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time. Continued success with the book as it moves into soft cover this coming fall. And again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really just an honor to be back on the air at WRTC.
It's great to have you, believe me. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
WRTC, Hartford.